ready to call the first case for today, 00-0221, Susan Lodl versus Progressive Northern Insurance Company. I have on my list Michelle Ford for 25 minutes representing Warsaw Underwriters, Mr. Kabish for 15 minutes representing Liberty Mutual, Mr. Thompson for 15 minutes representing, is it Lodl or Lodl? Lodl. And Mr. Ford, you, I'm sorry, Ms. Ford, you get 5 minutes in rebuttal. All right. Ms. Ford?
May it please the court. Sorry about that. I'm just trying to make it interesting for you. I am Michelle Ford, and I represent the petitioners, the Town of Pewaukee, the Town of Pewaukee Police Department, and Officer Brian M. Fredericks, the town's insurer, Warsaw Underwriters Insurance Company, in this matter. As the court knows, this case involves the application of immunity to police officers in situations where police officers act in response to traffic problems involving intersections where there are outages in control traffic signals. Although the trial court held that such situations do not give rise to a known and present danger such that immunity does not apply to officers, the Court of Appeals found that that was not the case. Now, the Court of Appeals held basically made three holdings. First, the court rejected the ministerial duty argument made by opposing counsel and opposing parties, and that holding has not been subject to a cross appeal. Although it is addressed in briefs, and I don't want to waive argument on the issue, I believe that the parties, the other parties, have waived argument on this issue because it has not been cross appealed. Secondly, I want to bring to the court's attention that my review of the pleadings indicate that it does not appear that Young and Liberty Mutual ever brought a direct claim or a counterclaim against the Town of Pewaukee or the Pewaukee defendants or Warsaw Insurance Companies. To the extent that Mr. Kabush is here to argue the appeal, the impact on that is up to the court. The Court of Appeals also held, and this is the most important thing, I think, and the reason why we are here and why we filed this petition, is that the court held that the known and present danger exception did apply, and the court held that an intersection with inoperative traffic signals presented a known and present danger, and also that the issue of whether what the officer did, Officer Fredericks did in this case, was an issue of fact. In other words, the issue of fact that the court found was whether or not the officers allegedly standing at the side of the road, rather than doing something more such as directing traffic, created a material issue of fact for the jury, such that the jury was to determine, did the officer do nothing in the face of a compelling and known danger, or did he do enough? We submit that this decision expands the known and present danger exception beyond what this court has ever intended, in fact, beyond, I think, what the legislature intended when it enacted 89380 sub 4. And if there was ever a case where this exception should not be expanded, this is the one.
Ms. Ford, if I can, I'd like to clarify for just a minute the position that you take in your reply brief. It's my understanding that what you're saying to us is, for purposes of summary judgment, we won't argue that the officer did anything other than arrive on the scene, place a stop sign, and call for backup, but that he did nothing else. Does that take dispute out of the idea of genuine issues of material fact?
That is correct. We have asked the trial court, we asked the Court of Appeals, and we ask this court to assume that all facts, all versions of events alleged by the other parties are true. What actually is undisputed is this, that the department sent officers out to drop folded up stop signs, which were attached to the poles on the traffic signals. They then dispatched Officer Frederick to the scene to monitor the situation. He presented himself at the intersection. According to his testimony and according to the testimony of the other driver, he was actually directing traffic through the intersection when the accident occurred, but we'll ask the court to assume for purposes of this motion that he was standing at the side of the road, as Mr. Young contends, with his arms down by his car. And that's what Mr. Young says he was doing, and that's all Mr. Young says he was doing.
So you're going ahead and agreeing that for purposes of summary judgment, we can assume that that set of facts is true.
Right. And the point, I'd like to make is there is essentially a two-part analysis to the known and present danger exception. First, there has to be a danger of such a compelling and known nature that it admits of only one response. The officer has to do something to alleviate the danger. And the court's decision is the only decision I'm aware of that has come out of the Supreme Court. And the court's decision involved a situation where a park manager neglected to take any action about a drop-off that led to a 90-foot gorge that was slightly off the path of a park that hikers used on a regular basis. The second prong of the exception requires that the officer take no action whatsoever to alleviate the danger. And this is important in this case because it is undisputed that the department actually took action in this case to alleviate the danger. The department sent out officers. We dropped stop signs. There's no dispute about that. We called Officer Fredericks to the scene. We asked him to address the problem. The accident occurred only 6 minutes after he arrived at the intersection. Now, the known and present danger, first of all, I'd like to address the issue of whether or not an outage of traffic control signals at an intersection should be characterized as a known and present danger. I think that this situation in Wisconsin, given the weather that we have and the storms that we have, is so common that the legislature contemplated it by addressing it in the rules of the road, specific statutes. Specifically, if traffic signals are operative, a driver is to obey them. If they're not operative and there are stop signs there, the driver is to obey the stop signs. If there are no traffic signals, the driver is to yield the right of way pursuant to statute. And to, let's say in Madison, we've got a 20-block radius of traffic signals that go out. 10 intersections are or a 20-block radius of power that goes out, powering the traffic signals. 10 intersections are affected, one of which has minimal travel. Are we going to adopt the known and present danger exception and say that on a stormy night, that intersection is of such a known and present danger that something more has to be done than simply checking out the intersection, making sure that manual stop signs are dropped, having an officer on the scene to review the situation? Are we going to hamstring our officers in terms of discretion by elevating that kind of a situation into the kind of known and present danger situation that this court has recognized? There is a difference, material difference, between a drop-off covered by bushes into a 90-foot gorge that a park manager knows about and completely ignores, and something so common as a traffic stop outage. And I believe that in analyzing the issue of whether or not the known and present danger exception has applied, this court has rejected application of basically evaluating the situation as to whether or not the danger rises to a sufficient level. What I think the known and present danger exception, what the rationale underlying it is, deliberate indifference on the part of an officer to a risk, not that someone might be harmed, but that it is substantially certain that someone will be harmed. Now, in this case, if, for example, there was a tree dropped in the middle of the intersection, the traffic lights were out, we might have a known and present danger because the risk is not just possible, it's probable that someone is going to be harmed. If we, for example, had a sinkhole in the middle of the intersection, that would be a situation where not only would a potential for an accident be possible it would be most likely. And it's only in those situations that I believe that the known and present danger exception was intended to apply.
So if an officer, what you're saying, if an officer goes to the intersection, no matter what he does, whether he has his arms at the side or he's out in the middle, even if the department had a policy that when you go to the intersection, and there was, a regular procedure that they had to deal with the rules of the road, that no matter, in either case, whether he's out in the intersection or he's standing along the side or he's sitting in his car, it doesn't make any difference.
Well, what I'm saying, Justice Wilcox, is not that necessarily, but that if we bind officers to a duty to be in the middle of an intersection, then what happens between the time they get there and the time they get their gear out and their flashlights out and they get into the middle of the intersection? This accident occurred 6 minutes after the officer arrived.
But you seem to be arguing for a blanket, meaning that because this happens so frequently, that it's not like the court's case, which the court is very familiar with. There would be no circumstance other than, hypothetically make up one where they never came to anything, they were called and they never came and there were frequent calls. But once the officer is there, it will always be discretionary.
That's correct. Once the officer responds, this court in Kemp's held that once a decision is made to do something to address a danger, what is done has to be left to the discretion of the officer. And we can't, as lawyers and as justices, exercise 20/20 hindsight and say this accident happened and therefore we must look back. And this court has recognized this. We must look back and say, This must have been a danger, and it must have been a known and present danger because the accident happened.
Ms. Ford, how do you get around the Pewaukee Police Department policy manual? 4.23 is the one that's been called to our attention through the briefs, and that seems to set forth very definitive instructions to the officer as to how to conduct traffic, how to handle a traffic situation similar to this. Isn't that something that we have to look at and take into account here?
Well, the policy itself was described in detail, and the Chief Stone, who actually drafted the policy, indicated that his intent was to allow for the exercise of discretion of the officers. The language in the policy is discretionary and not mandatory, and it's prefaced by a paragraph that says that officers are expected to use their discretion because of the variety of situations in which they are confronted. There is nothing in the language of this policy that imposes a mandatory duty so absolute, certain, and imperative that nothing remained for Officer Frederick's discretion and judgment, which is the very definition of a ministerial duty. So the Court of Appeals, I believe, correctly rejected the argument that the policy itself and the rules of the road did not contain any rules that specifically prescribed Officer Frederick's conduct once he got to the intersection. There are a couple of problems with leaving this issue, the issue of whether Officer Frederick's did enough, to the jury. Was it enough that the department called him to the scene? Was it enough that stop signs were placed? Was it enough that he responded? These are issues that are relative to a negligence inquiry, not an immunity inquiry. We have to presume that he stood by the road and he was negligent.
Your position is that even if he is negligent, he's immune.
This court has repeatedly held that the issue of negligence is presumed, must be presumed, and but for negligence, we wouldn't have no need for immunity. In the Kirsten decision, for example, this court observed that to be the rule. And this court has repeatedly rejected the arguments that have been set forth here for that very reason. If he wasn't potentially negligent, we wouldn't even have to consider whether or not he was immune. Now, immunity is important for public officials for this reason. public officers. Private sector employees and corporations have the liberty of deciding what sort of business they want to get into and what kind of dangers they want to assume in getting into those businesses. Municipalities, unfortunately, do not have that luxury. We have the obligation to ensure the safety of streets and sidewalks. We have the obligation to assist in firefighting activities. We have the obligation to assist in murder investigations. We, police officers, deal every day with dangerous situations. To elevate a situation such as this to a known and present danger would, I think, create a slippery slope where police officers in particular and firefighters also would be subject to this problem where because the activities that they deal with are inherently dangerous in nature, virtually every situation they confront could fairly be characterized and probably will be argued under the Court of Appeals decision to be a known and present danger.
Counsel, I find blurred the distinction that you're making, and not that you're blurring it, but I find conceptually blurred, the distinction between negligence, the negligent behavior of the officer, and what you assert is a component of the definition of clear and present danger, or known and present danger. That same blurring, I find in the Court of Appeals opinion, and I am quick to acknowledge the only blurring maybe in my mind rather than there. But let me start with the blurring that I'm talking about. That is the negligent activity with a definition of what is a known and present danger. I look at the first paragraph of the Court of Appeals opinion, and that reads, for relevance of what my inquiry is, therefore we reverse the circuit court's grant of summary judgment because there is a genuine issue of material fact. What is the genuine issue of material fact?
The genuine issue of material fact that the Court of Appeals found, and with all due respect to the Court of Appeals, I disagreed with strenuously, is the issue of whether once the court decided a known present danger existed, the court found there was a material issue of fact as to whether or not the officer did enough, or he did nothing by standing at the side of the road, or did something, or should have done something. And that is a tantamount to saying, let's let the jury decide whether or not he was negligent. What the Court of Appeals effectively did, without using the words, is created a standard of care for officers in this situation.
May I interrupt?
I'm sorry.
No, that's because it is exactly the words that you said that focused the inquiry for me. The difference between whether the officer did enough, which encompasses looking at the circumstances and the officer's behavior and see whether or not he failed, considering everything, to do enough, which we usually call negligence or could call negligence, or doing enough versus doing anything. And that's the discord here. That's the... Do you understand what I'm arguing?
Your Honor, I apologize if I was not clear, but that is my principal criticism of, again, with all due respect, that's my principal criticism of the Court of Appeals analysis.
Now, your position is that the inquiry is that there has to be a known and present danger as part in order to qualify for the known and present danger exception. I think your position is, number one, there has to be a known and present danger, 90-foot fall, some kind of known and present danger, and, number two, that the officer took no action whatsoever.
That's right.
Now, that's in tension with some of the language of the cases. I mean, this is one of the things we're arguing. That's in tension with, is there have to be a known and present danger, and there's an issue of fact whether they did enough. I mean, that's And I think the language of this opinion obscures that, and the language of other opinions obscure that.
I agree, and I direct the court's attention, for example, to the Kirsten decision, where...
Brilliant decision, I think, wasn't it? I can't remember who wrote that.
I believe it was you, Justice Bradley.
Oh, okay.
And actually, I was representing the... defendants. The court has repeatedly rejected this blurring of the negligence standard with the immunity standard. Now, to allow this issue to go to the jury would be equivalent to asking the jury to say, when you've got this situation, is it enough? Is it a meeting a standard of care to stand by the side of the road? Or is the standard of care really to go in the middle of the intersection or do something more?
Now, if I go with you in regard to your oral argument, you say they have to do something. Well, isn't showing up at the scene qualify as something?
Justice, that has been my position for the duration of this lawsuit. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's all they have to do is show up at the scene. They can show up at the scene and stand there and look at the moon. That's all they need.
Well, no, that is not my position. But my position is, in this particular case, that's not what happened. In this particular case, and we have to remember that the department is also a defendant. The department sent other officers to address the situation before Officer Fredericks even got there. So even if Officer Fredericks had been dispatched to a domestic dispute, we already have a situation where a known present danger was addressed. In courts, the criticism with the park manager was that he knew about it, but he did nothing, nothing. Of all of the things that he could have done to protect individuals, he chose to do nothing. In the Domino case, the criticism there was that the squad car that was sent to address the downed tree was rerouted, and the individuals chose to do nothing.
I think it's a matter of interpretation, and I certainly respect your interpretation. Another interpretation of the court's opinion in Cords, for instance, that he acted negligently, comma, indeed, he didn't even do anything. You know, that was a comment as part of the overall negligence. That's another interpretation.
Yes, Justice Bradley, I agree, but the problem is if we adopt the Court of Appeals decision, we are leaving immunity to the jury. Now, immunity not only promises immunity from trial, immunity promises immunity from suit, from the burdens of discovery. In fact, this court has adopted the rule that if a complaint does not allege a cause of action against a municipal official or a municipality that falls outside the scope of immunity, the claim against the municipality has to be dismissed. So to allow the immunity issue to go to trial would really defeat the purpose of protecting the public fisc and not requiring taxpayers to have to pay to defend against these lawsuits in situations where it is neither pled in the pleadings or clear from the record that one of the exceptions, one of the four exceptions this court has outlined, applies. And in this case, again, I want to reserve the right to, we address the policy issue and the ministerial duty issue as, I believe, being correctly addressed by the Court of Appeals. The known and present danger exception, in this case, I believe, should not apply.
Your position can be summarized, and if I'm wrong, you correct me. One, this doesn't fall within known and present danger, right?
For three reasons. A situation of this type does not present such a compelling and known risk of substantial and almost certain injury to individuals that nothing would remain for Officer Frederick's discretion but to get in the middle of the intersection and direct traffic. The second reason is that the department and Officer Fredericks took action to address the danger, and that was not the case in courts, not the case in any of the seminal decisions on the danger, known and present danger exception. The third reason applying the exception in this case would be, I believe, lead to more lawsuits and more appeals on the application of this exception to virtually any dangerous situation confronted by police officers or law enforcement officials in general where injury occurs. And the fourth, I guess, is that the issue of immunity is always been viewed in this by this court as a question of law, not a question of fact.
What was the first part of your statement?
The issue of immunity has always been viewed as a question of law under undisputed facts, and we do not dispute the facts for purposes of this motion. And again, if we send this to the jury for a determination, we are blurring the distinction between negligence and immunity, which we really cannot do. We have to assume that Officer Fredericks was negligent. He was negligent. Now, the question is...
Those are your four arguments.
Those are my four arguments, Your Honor.
If it is known and present, and the government does something, does that take it out of known and present?
If it's known and present and the government does something to address the situation...
Yes. It takes it out of the known and present concept. That's your interpretation.
Right. It's not enough that, presumably, it would not be enough for the government just to answer the phone and then hang up the phone. And in fact, in Domino, a squad was dispatched, but then rerouted, and the court found that was not enough. In this situation, there was an officer at the scene.
Suppose for an hour, 2 hours, electricity is shut out in Madison. Take any community, every light goes off. Every intersection light goes off. If that is a known and present danger, is the government then liable for every traffic accident at an intersection?
Well, that is the thing that we as petitioners are trying to avoid. That is the rule of law that we do not believe should be adopted and was effectively adopted by the Court of Appeals. And that is our position. Now, my warning light is on. I'm not entirely sure if that means that my 25 minutes are up or my 30 minutes.
No, your 25 minutes are not up. They will be up. The red light goes on, which will happen shortly.
I'm a first-timer. I apologize. With regard to... The one thing I also do want to say... I think the most important point here is we don't want to, again, blur the distinction between negligence and immunity, and my red light just went on.
You may finish the sentence.
Thank you. Oh, well.
We don't want to blur the distinction between
immunity and
negligence and immunity, and we do not want to create a situation where police officers who face dangerous situations every day are subject to lawsuits based on a newly created and expanded exception. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ford. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel representing Mr. Young and Liberty Mutual.
Thank you. My name is Tom Kabush, and I'm here representing Liberty Mutual Insurance Company and Walker Young, Jr. Our argument in this case is fairly simple. Our argument is the intersection on the night of this accident presented an immediate and known danger that required the police department and its officers to take some action to warn and protect the public, and that there are material issues of fact regarding whether or not the police department and the officers did anything at all to respond to this danger. Therefore, summary judgment is inappropriate.
Well, just ask what they did take some action. They dropped the signs, they were there, and opposing counsel indicated that even if one adopts her version of facts, standing on her side of the road was sufficient to take some action. This makes it fall in discretionary rather than ministerial.
Well, I disagree with the argument that standing on the side of the road and merely responding to the intersection is enough. I think more is required when you have a danger such as this one. I think the police department had a duty, a ministerial duty, when confronted with this known danger to warn the public of the danger. And I think that's consistent with the holding in the Cords case and the Domino case. Merely responding was not enough. They had to do more. And I think on the undisputed facts, all we can assume is that the police officer went to the intersection, stood by the side of his car and did nothing. And I think a jury could take those, the disputed facts between Mr. Young's testimony and Officer Frederick's, and conclude that the police officer did nothing more than that, than stand at the side of his car. And it's our argument that he was required to do more. He was required to either, whatever it was, place flares, make sure the stop signs were open. We have Officer Ryman's testimony that 20 minutes earlier he had opened these fold-out stop signs. But we have Officer Frederick's testimony that when he got at the intersection, he didn't see any stop signs.
But isn't the concern I have, just pointed out in the brief, is once you open this up, once you say, well, yes, the officer should have done this, didn't do this, or the officer in another situation goes to an accident and should have done something differently, but he or she did, then you appear to the so-called veil of immunity and you open this area up to what is the best course of action. Unless I'm wrong, that seems to be what you're saying, that you can't just, well, I think Justice Bradley used, if you go there and you look at the moon and cars are streaming through, that might be, quote, obvious exception. But here the officer was there, we have, something was done, and that is always the case where officers may not, or firemen may not do the right thing, but they did something.
They did something 20 minutes earlier. Officer Fredericks was dispatched because apparently there was some continuing problem and they continued to receive phone calls. So what was done earlier apparently was not enough. The public was still concerned about it and still calling in. And I think if you look at the record and the phone log that's attached to the appendix to my brief, one of those phone calls was actually a pretty hysterical phone call about the problem at the intersection before the accident.
The accident had occurred while he was en route, after he had been dispatched, so a response was made to the known and present danger, but the accident unfortunately occurred while he was en route, or perhaps just as he was arriving.
Then he obviously wouldn't have had an opportunity to do anything, and I don't think I could argue that we could pierce the immunity veil in that circumstance. But in this case, we know that he got there before the accident. We know that, according to his testimony, he had time to go out into the center of the intersection. And when he did that, his testimony is that cars were whizzing by and not obeying any rules of the road, not yielding to anybody. And he had time, according to his testimony, to try to gain control of that intersection. Now, that testimony is disputed, but that's giving us a time frame that says he had time to do something. And I think what we have to assume for this summary judgment motion is exactly what Justice Bradley said. He stood by the side of his car and he looked at the moon and did nothing. And that's the balancing that has to take place here.
And what if it turns out that the reason why he was standing beside the side of the road looking at the moon and doing nothing was because he had just called for backup? He had determined it was too dangerous to stand in the middle of the intersection under those circumstances. He had called for backup and was waiting for backup to arrive.
Right, but that's not our record on the summary judgment motion.
Oh, I'm posing that hypothetical.
Okay. Well, my argument, and Mr. Thompson's going to agree with me, my argument would be if he got to the intersection and said, this is just too dangerous for me to do anything at this point, I need help, I need to call for backup, my argument is that's fine. He did something. He recognized the danger. He's going to make an attempt to warn the public, but he needs more help.
Right. Isn't that tantamount to giving the immunity question to the jury, which is not the way it's supposed to go? The application of immunity is for the court to decide.
Well, no. I think that the Court of Appeals decision is right here. I think the jury question here is for the jury to figure out whose testimony they're going to believe as far as what this officer did or did not do. If the jury concludes that this officer did nothing, then immunity does not apply and the town can be held liable. If the jury concludes that this officer took some action to address the danger, then it's my argument that immunity does apply, and that's for the court to decide then, and there would be no liability.
The difficulty with that position, I think, and I'm just, that will make it a typical situation if the court goes that way, that there's always disputed testimony. There's always, at least in my experience, your version and somebody else's version of what took place. And as Justice Sykes is indicating, then that means that this whole question would be shifted to a jury who will then decide whether or not there was or was not immunity. And I mean, that will become the typical situation.
But if it's not, then we're allowing the court to decide issues of fact and questions of fact, deciding whose testimony is credible and whose isn't in this case. And that's never been the court's function either. It's been always for a jury to decide those issues of fact. And I think the jury has to decide the issues of fact in this case as to whether they're going to believe Mr. Young or Officer Fredericks. The other balancing, and I think the heart of my argument here is, what type of policy do we want this rule of law to encourage? I believe this known and present danger exception to immunity is designed to encourage public officers to take some action when they know of a danger to warn and protect the public. And if we apply immunity at this stage of this proceeding to facts where we're taking undisputed facts that the officer got there and did nothing, we're going to be encouraging public officers in the future to respond and do nothing to warn the public of a danger. And
suppose all those lights go out in Milwaukee. You're in Milwaukee, and you don't even have to do all of it. Two-thirds of the city will probably do it. Probably don't have enough police officers to get to every intersection, right?
That's correct.
What does that mean under your theory of this case?
Well, I think I would have to argue that they have a duty to do what they can to address the problem. It'd be impossible for them to address every intersection in the city due to the lack of employees to deal with it. But they'd have to take some action. I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of what it would be. They'd have to work with the public utility to get the lights back, the electricity back working. Whatever it might be, I don't know. But you're taking it far beyond where we are in this case.
Your theory is that there's a known and present danger. Is that right?
Yes.
Is there anything in the record to indicate whether the officer kept his bubble gums on?
Well, he said he did not keep his lights on the top of his blue and white lights on the top of his car activated. The officer testified he activated an amber distributional bar in the back. I believe it's in the back window of the squad car. Mr. Young testified that he didn't see any lights at all activated on the squad car.
So what's the fact that we're working with here? Do we have to assume there were no lights?
I believe you have to. I believe you have to take Mr. Young's testimony because we're the ones opposing summary judgment and assume that there were no lights activated on the squad car.
So you're saying then that for purposes of the summary judgment, the only thing we have before us, or what we have to assume, is that all that the officer did was drive to the scene and stand by the side of his car?
That's what I'm saying we have to assume for purposes of this summary judgment motion, because that's all that's undisputed.
Counsel, if all the lights went out in Milwaukee, as the Chief Justice was talking about, and let's say you had 50 officers on 50 different intersections, and maybe there were four or five accidents that happened because of this incident. And each, as I gather your argument, isn't enough to be there. Each officer might have responded a little bit differently according to what was happening. But then would the argument be that, you get to the jury on those because you would have a different set of facts as the officer, and then it would be up to the jury to decide. I think that's the concern that...
Well, my argument would be if one of those officers went there and did nothing at that particular intersection, he wouldn't be entitled to immunity. But if you had different officers deciding different ways to address the situation, one officer places flares along the roads, another officer activates his squad car lights, that's enough action to entitle them.
Isn't the difficulty, though, that you'll always, what I'm getting at is that, yes, he may not be entitled to immunity, but the argument will be made that your position would be he did this, his position would be he did that, and then that's what I'm saying, that this then goes to the jury to make that decision.
Would go to the jury. Yeah, I think that in a circumstance where you have a known and compelling danger, that that's the policy, the rule of law that we want to support. Because I don't think we want to support having not only police officers, but other public employees who are presented with dangers being encouraged to do nothing to protect the public from those dangers when they're in a position to do something about it.
Counsel, I want to make sure I understand the stipulation, to the extent there's a stipulation of what the record is before us. Earlier, in response to Justice Crooks's question as to what we have before us as a record, your opposing counsel acknowledged what we have is arriving at the scene, placing a stop sign, calling for backup, and nothing else. Now,
I disagree with that.
Okay, what do you understand? Now, in response to Justice Babbage, you said showed up and stood by the car.
That's what I believe. I would submit that if you look at the Officer Frederick's testimony, which is contained in the appendix to my brief, there's nothing in there that says he placed a stop sign at the intersection. And his testimony was he went to the middle of the intersection, and while in the middle of the intersection, he called for a portable stop sign. He could not remember if he requested backup assistance. I believe that's his testimony. So I don't believe that we can assume that he, in fact, I don't think it's supported by the record that he placed any stop sign at that intersection before this accident.
The question, of course, is whether or not, at least as I see it, is whether or not the officer, the situation called for the officer to exercise any judgment. You, of course, are saying that
I'm saying that if we take these undisputed facts, he didn't exercise any judgment, therefore there's no immunity at all.
The question I have is this, and it may sound silly, but I've been known to ask some silly questions. Isn't doing nothing here under these circumstances, assuming he simply went and stood by the side of his car, isn't doing nothing here the same as doing something?
I don't think so, but it sounds like he may be leading me someplace else.
Well, he goes there. He's got a number of judgment calls to make. Let me play the devil's advocate with you. He sees the traffic whipping by. He decides, in his discretion, that there is nothing he can do at this point. So he does nothing. Therefore, he's doing something.
If that would have been his testimony, I think that might present a different situation.
I'm taking your... You're saying before us, we have these facts, and he sat there and did nothing. And I'm saying, isn't doing nothing the same as doing something?
No. I think that when we're presented with a danger such as this, we have to have a rule of law that encourages him to do something more than stand by the side of his car.
To follow this up, would you fill in the end of this sentence? Has to do something to what?
Warn the public of the danger that's present.
Now, is it warn the public or is it to cure the danger? What's the end of your sentence? Is that
my argument is, and I'm basing it on what I believe I can glean out of Cords and Domino, he has a duty to warn the public.
Could I ask you what you think, if you prevail, what the special verdict questions are would be, or what exactly would the jury be deciding?
I think the verdict question for the jury is, did Officer Fredericks take action to warn the public of the danger presented at the intersection, yes or no? If they answer that yes, he took some action, then I believe the court applies immunity to this case. If they answer it no, he didn't take any action, then I believe that there's no immunity and he can be held liable and he's on the verdict with the rest of the defendants.
Would there be a question about the presence of stop signs?
I don't think the verdict question would have to be that specific. I think it would just be, did he take any action to warn the public?
I mean, is putting up stop signs warning the public?
Yes, it would be. But he didn't, I don't think this record supports that he did that. And if stop signs were opened, By the time he was there, they clearly were not visible to the public because they continued to receive phone calls. He even testified he didn't see stop signs there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bush. Mr. Thompson.
May it please the court, Mark Thompson on behalf of Susan Lodl. This decision of this court is going to decide whether or not there is a court's exception to discretionary immunity. And I want to say what this case is first and then what it isn't. This is a case about an intersection in Waukesha County, Highway 190, Capitol Road, and County J. Capitol Road is 55 miles per hour, and J is 45 miles per hour. The lights on the street go down, and the lights itself at the intersection are down. This is an intersection that the chief of police on Milwaukee said it was a dangerous intersection. The decision was a legislative decision had been made, put the lights at that intersection. I concur with the Court of Appeals when they say, as a matter of law, that night, that storm, that intersection was a compelling and known danger. Under Cords, I believe, that decides the immunity issue. Because I agree with Ms. Ford on this question. Immunity has to be an issue of law in the first instance. I disagree with Mr. Tabush on the issue of whether it should go to the jury. I do not think the jury decides immunity. This Court of Appeals, and I'm asking this court to determine that this intersection under these circumstances constituted a known and compelling danger which required action. And I submit their ministerial acts with respect to directing traffic at an intersection. This case is not about the decision of a police department faced with a broad emergency shutdown as to which officers to go to which stoplight to direct traffic. Honestly, if you're faced at the city of Milwaukee, and I live there, it's shut down. The chief of police, the mayor, is not going to be in a position to send and man every intersection. This decision doesn't say that every intersection automatically, therefore, becomes a known and compelling danger, compelling action.
Well, clearly, I would assume that you would agree that even if a ministerial duty is created because of a known and compelling danger, the duty does not compel an officer to act in such a way as to put himself in danger or put others in danger.
I agree 100%, and that's not what this case is about. Because I think the facts...
What's the case about, then?
The facts from my point of view are going to be a little different, again, than counsel here. I believe Officer Fredericks testified truthfully when he said he was in the middle of the intersection. He directed Radmer to stop, and Radmer disregarded his acts. Radmer's decision to violate that officer's direction not to enter the eastbound lanes was a substantial factor causing this accident. This may be a case where Officer Fredericks may be found not negligent because he exercised ordinary care under the circumstances he faced at that intersection. He may even be entitled to an emergency instruction in terms of his duties and obligations. Because by showing up and acting, he didn't create that emergency. Mr. Young, speeding through, not slowing, may have created. He's not entitled to the emergency instruction. And Mr. Radmer, certainly, who disregarded Officer Fredericks, isn't entitled to that. The question, I think the jury can answer whether or not Officer Fredericks acted with ordinary care under these circumstances. This is a juries every day in this state decide intersection decisions. Who has the right of way, who failed to yield the right of way, who was going too fast. This isn't about a question of a police officer arresting someone or deciding to arrest someone. This is a question where you have an intersection and common sense dictates that only one direction, east or west or north or south, at any one point in time has the right of way to go through. The officer, when he gets there, makes the decision on how to proceed to do that. I think that the compelling danger wipes out the immunity, and the jury can address the issues. I think it has to be in questions of ordinary care. Otherwise, it's unworkable.
Counsel, on your brief, you say, Officer Fredericks may have had discretion to decide how he should deal with the dangerous situation. You agree with that?
Correct.
Once he exercised his discretion, he had a ministerial duty to control the intersection in accordance with police department policy and the rules of the road. I don't understand that.
In my brief, we articulated in terms of Officer Fredericks, because this wasn't a case where there's a chief of police deciding how to man several intersections. Okay? There may have been a good reason not to show up at the intersection. We know that that was an issue in this case. He shows up. Once he's there, it is a simple question to ask the jury, did he exercise ordinary care and control?
We have to talk about immunity, right? You've said immunity is a question of law, not for the jury, all right? So I want to get to what does the judge do, all right? Now the judge is deciding immunity. Now the first thing the judge has to do is decide whether it's a danger, right? A compelling and known danger, right?
I think that's what this court and courts says decides the immunity issue.
Okay, that's it. Once you say it's compelling and known danger, there's no immunity. Is that what your point is? And it goes to the jury as to negligence.
Whether, yes. Because the idea of in that, the idea in courts was that this danger was so clear.
Let me just stop you. Because I think we may have a question of law that we have to settle. If I understood counsel, I understood Ms. Ford, it's her position that you not only have to have a compelling and known danger to get over immunity, but the public official, the officer, has to do nothing. Now, if I hear you right, you say once there's a compelling and known danger, immunity is gone. Now we go immediately to negligence. Is that a difference of the interpretation of the law between the two of you?
I believe Cords says.
Well, tell me
first. Yes, it is, absolutely.
Okay, good. Now
yes.
We got that settled.
Because Cords' comment and Domino's comment, you see, in Domino, they did something. If the rule was you didn't do anything, there would have been immunity there because they dispatched and then they had something else and they changed their mind. Immunity wasn't granted. The point was this, there's something across the road that's dangerous. Once you dispatch, now the jury is going to decide whether to exercise ordinary care in dealing with that. Because you see, I think if
isn't that the position I advocated in Kirsten in my dissent, and 5-2, the majority disagreed with me.
I think that the difference in Kirsten was we weren't dealing with a known and compelling danger. Okay, what we're talking about is a specific dangerous situation. And I think under these facts, where they dispatched to that intersection, where they agreed it's dangerous, then it resolves the immunity issue.
And now the jury decides whether or not they exercise ordinary care. I do not think this opens up the door to every situation, particularly the Chief Justice raised, in terms of what happens if you really have an emergency. Because obviously then, the quasi-judicial, quasi-legislative decision in terms of where to deploy comes into play.
My problem is, why doesn't it open up the door? Because I'm still back perhaps with the questions I asked the other counsel on why, what is so different about this intersection or these situations? Because it's, you'll have the different testimony. That's, it's an adversarial system. You'll have the officer will say, I did this. And the person injured or whatever will say that's what they did. And what I'm saying is, how do you distinguish? It has to be a knowing and compelling danger, okay? But
I think the way I've looked at it and tried to understand this court's decision in Cords and the Court of Appeals decision on Domino, it was looking for a certain condition that existed. We have an intersection, high speeds, unlighted, a known, the chief of police says, very dangerous. Now, they made the decision to deploy. I think they lose immunity with this known and dangerous, and then the jury decides whether he was negligent or not. In this case, they may actually find that the city wasn't, or the town wasn't negligent. I think the focus has to be on the danger. Because if it's on the conduct or the response, we eviscerate the exception. Because then every time someone does something, they respond. Because you see, I think you can't logically, how do you put it to the jury that they got there, he showed up at the side of the road, he turned it on, he was on the phone calling help making a decision. Well, he did something. But it's still known and dangerous. Now, it may have been reasonable. And I think we should not confuse negligence and immunity. If it's dangerous, immunity goes out, and then the jury determines whether or not Officer Fredericks exercised ordinary care, and he may have. You see, what happens, and this is not a known and compelling danger example. What if you have a slow-speed intersection? The lights are out. Traffic's backed way up. One of the corners is blind. You got an officer standing there, and he recklessly directs one car into another. Why shouldn't you be able to sue him for negligence? I mean, you know, why not? It's ministerial. He violated. There's no requirement it's deliberate indifference. This isn't a civil rights claim. We're not talking about that. This is about negligence. Now, that case isn't here, but that doesn't open up the, you know, Pandora's box. But certainly, you should be able to sue him if he did it. So I think what makes this case a very good opportunity for this court to illuminate the case law is, I think it says, immunity is a question of law in the first instance. The court looks at to determine whether there is a known and compelling danger. Once that's determined, the issue goes to the jury to determine whether or not they exercise ordinary care.
I think you're leaving out the second half of the analysis under the known and present danger exception to immunity, which is that there has to exist a known and present danger of such force that the time, mode, and occasion for performance is evident with such certainty, and this is the second part, that nothing remains for the exercise of judgment and discretion. And what the Court of Appeals did in this case is basically gut that or bypass that second part of the equation. And so if there was a perfectly good reason for the officer to be standing by the side of the road instead of standing in the middle of the intersection, that would not relieve him from liability because the Court of Appeals has said as a matter of law he was required to be in the middle of the intersection.
I don't read the Court of Appeals saying as a matter of law he's required to be there. I have a problem with the Court of Appeals saying the jury goes back and decides what he did. The reason I say that in this instance there's a known and compelling danger where the duties are the requisite absoluteness or certainty is because at an intersection, the basic rule of the road is, and Officer Fredericks had to do this, he had to make sure that traffic east or west had the right of way at a time that north and south didn't. That's his duty. That was his duty. Now, if it meant in doing that, calling for additional help to do it, I think he's entitled to argue to the jury that he exercised ordinary care, but I think the issue should go to the jury in the first instance.
That's not what the known and present danger exception is all about, though. The exception takes it out of the discretionary function of the officer. I mean, immunity exists to protect those decisions from being litigated, basically. That's the whole purpose of immunity, is to protect public officers from having their discretionary judgment calls litigated in court and second-guessed in court after the fact, right?
I agree.
And so the only reason you would create an exception to that is if there is such a compelling danger that the duty is no longer admits of any discretion or, as Justice Babbage said, judgment whatsoever, nor any excuses for the non-performance, but is ministerial and must be performed such that if it wasn't, you've got summary judgment liability and you're on the hook.
May I answer
you
that question?
You should answer it.
Thank you. I believe courts provides guidance on that. Courts said he either didn't warn or he didn't report the danger. There wasn't anything absolute in what he had to do. He had to respond to address it. The court didn't say if he would have told the supervisor 2 days later that there was immunity. Immunity was gone. Then the question is whether or not that was ordinary care.
But by saying there wasn't anything absolute that he had to do, you're conceding it was a discretionary decision and not ministerial.
And what I'm saying is this, that courts and Domino in all the cases have always said, look, we're thinking beings. The issue is whether that decision is one that is protected by immunity. When Officer Fredericks got there, it was absolutely clear to him, certain enough, that he had to direct who had the right of way at the intersection, just as it was to the park ranger to know whether he had to go report someone or put a sign up. There wasn't a rule that said you have to put a sign up. Certainly, if he would have put a sign up away from the cliff, the jury could have found that he was negligent. Immunity wouldn't have applied. The issue was the danger so compelling? If it's so compelling that mandated response is required, i.e. you must perform traffic control at this intersection, then it's a jury question. Otherwise, if that isn't it, there is no court's exception because everything will be engulfed with, well, I did something. And then we've eviscerated the exception. And we're talking about public employees where liability is the rule rather than immunity, unlike state employees. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Ms. Boyd, you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you. First, going to address Mr. Kabush's argument to the extent that he represented some facts that he believed to be true. It's not undisputed that all Officer Fredericks did when he arrived at the intersection was look at the moon. It's undisputed that he did call for backup. He also called for a portable stop sign. It's undisputed that folded stop signs were dropped, and I don't want to repeat myself. The fact that Fredericks doesn't recall seeing them doesn't mean they were there. He never said they were not there. And
also,
that is not
change the facts, was if he was there, he looked at the moon, and in the meantime, he called the Bucks ticket office to find out whether he could get tickets to the game, then what?
Well, this goes back to my point that it's not enough to take action. You have to take action to remedy the situation. So as I said, it's not, for example, as I said, the example in Domino is a good example where the dispatcher dispatched the squad car and then diverted the squad car to another incident. There was a conscious decision not to address this particular situation of danger. Action alone is not enough, but the action alone, general action, was not what happened here. And I would refer the court's attention to pages 15 and 39 and 40 of Officer Frederick's deposition regarding his undisputed testimony that he did call for backup. Now, we have Officer Bach, another member of the department, who testified that he himself would not have gone in the middle of the intersection because he would have been afraid for his own safety, and he would have been afraid that his presence in the middle would compromise the safety of others. So if two officers can reasonably disagree on what is the appropriate course of action in this kind of situation, then this is a situation calling for discretion. This is a situation that does not admit of one response.
Counsel, there was an interesting interchange between a number of us and Mr. Thompson about the analytical framework that we employ in addressing these questions. And it seemed to be if I understood Mr. Thompson's position correctly, he is saying that once the court determines as a matter of law that the situation was a known and present danger, compelling danger, whatever it is, that resolves the question of immunity, and that no immunity attaches. That's what I think his analytical framework is. Now, I think yours is different than that. I think what you're saying is, even if we determine that there's a known and compelling danger, that does not end the inquiry. Could you enlighten us on your position?
Yes, Justice Babbage, and I think you stated the positions correctly, and in fact, this court has already confronted that issue. I don't think that we can say that if there's a known and present danger, that no matter what the officer does or does not do, he's automatically divested of immunity, because there are known and present dangers officers are confronted with every day. The question is not whether, for immunity, should not be whether or not they're confronted with an extreme danger, but what they did or did not do in response, whether they did nothing in response. And I'll read an excerpt from Kimps versus Hill. Once an officer does take action within the scope of his official duties in response to a compelling and known danger, his decision about what action is appropriate under the circumstances is discretionary. This issue has already been decided by this court. Mr. Thompson's argument, with all due respect, has already been rejected.
Counsel, what language in courts, if any, can you point to, because I see that as the seminal case, what language in courts, if any, can you point to for the establishment of this two-pronged test that you assert?
Well, the language in Cords that I can direct the court's attention to is the language wherein the Supreme Court states there are two paragraphs, effectively, or three paragraphs, and I'll just grab the case.
Perhaps page 541 is maybe the focus of your
response. Well, before, without fumbling to determine whether or not I can find it, the court observed, the court held that this was a known and present danger, and the court stated something to the effect of all of the possible actions the park manager could have taken, calling the management, placing a sign. He elected to do nothing in the face of a situation where he knew there was a danger. So from that language...
And then it goes on to say, and therefore he is liable. Liability, of course, is the combination of lack of immunity with negligence equals liability. So I have a problem with you pointing to that to say that.
Well, then I would rely on the Kemp's decision, where this court stated once an officer chooses to address a known and compelling danger, his actions are discretionary and entitled to immunity. The two-part test analysis is my, my way of working out the test in my own, the analysis in my own mind. I don't think there's ever been a situation where the court has actually enunciated it as a two-part test. I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Ford, Mr. Bush, and Mr. Thompson.